report we'll call him here is Natalie Lowinger and the estate of Stephen J. Lowinger.
Good morning. May it please the court, Patrick Merkel on behalf of Natalia Lowinger. We have a matter here which will strain conventional wisdom, and that's what we need to look at. We are straining conventional wisdom because under conventional
Before we get there, do we want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Such time as I have remaining, I request that I leave.
Okay, sir.
Marital property disposed of before the date of divorce is not subject to equitable distribution, and that's the maxim that Judge Cahill applied in this case in determining that the equity from the Bethesda house, which had been generated in cash in 2004, 8 years before the parties divorced, was no longer available for equitable distribution in 2012. I ask the court, first of all, we agree with the maxim and with this conventional wisdom, but we differ in that equity in the Bethesda house was specifically excluded from treatment as joint property to be subject to equitable distribution under this premarital agreement.
Well, as a starting matter, why shouldn't this, and this will sound more critical than I mean for it to be, but why shouldn't we dismiss this appeal on the basis of 5A20? The only authorities cited were for the standard of review. Were you not able to find any cases supporting your proposition?
The idea that the parties are entitled to a de novo review of a contract under Virginia law,
right,
is what we cited for our standard of review, and it's in effect a law between the parties needing to be interpreted by this court, and that another maxim of law.
Right, but you were not able to find any cases analogous to the situation that you have here.
No, not at all. I have not seen a situation where this is an unusual contract. There's a provision in there under joint property which says the joint property, which is going to be the after-acquired property, is subject to equitable distribution. And it doesn't say equitable distribution under the statute. We just presume that that's what it meant.
Well, isn't it fair to say that the contract, the prenuptial agreement, said nothing about preserving the equity that came out of the house in the event that the sale occurred before any divorce?
That's correct, but I don't think it had to say that. And that's because the provision in the agreement simply stated that except as otherwise provided in this agreement, okay, nobody can make any claim during the marriage for either side's property or for that matter even marital property. And then it goes on to distinguish between the Bethesda house, which is prior separate property owned by the husband, and the joint property to be acquired afterward. And with respect to the Bethesda house, it states that the appreciation beyond the value shown in Exhibit A, which was basically a $500,000 value, shall be treated as marital property. It's the only provision in here that talks about marital property, which we know is actually
But in point of fact, what happened 8 years before the divorce, that
right,
the residence was sold, the
right,
equity portion was put in husband's account, but it was spent by both the husband and wife during the next 8 years, wasn't it? Or spent down to $16 left?
You know, the financial control during the marriage was exclusively on the husband's part, as I'm sure you're aware, since you've already, you have delved into this case and you know this case. It is a little bit complicated. But what's important is to keep in mind the four concepts that were embodied in this premarital agreement from the outset in order for it to be fair. First of all, it's supposedly that it is itself the exclusive remedy, and the parties actually waive equitable distribution in the agreement, and then they bring it back in through this provision at joint property.
But wait, if fairness is the standard, didn't wife get a new car, among other things, out of the equity that she now wants to recover again?
Anything that was new was completely subject to debt, Your Honor, and we never really addressed that kind of stuff.
Anything that was new
I'm
was...
looking at the agreement.
Can you say that again? Anything that was new was subject to debt?
Judge Hall is asking me why is it fair for her to claim this chunk of the money at the point in time of divorce when she got a car out of the deal when the Bethesda house was sold. We didn't bring the evidence in, Your Honor, but if you wanted to go and look back at that, we would show that that was at most a down payment made to acquire the vehicle, and Mr. Lowinger took advantage of low interest rates basically during the entire time of the parties.
$38,000 down payment?
That's not, it was a $38,000 purchase, but it's not what was, it was a finance vehicle.
No.
It was my recollection. But again, there's four concepts in this agreement. That it's an exclusive remedy, number one, and that equitable distribution is waived by both parties. Only joint property, the paragraph at page 7 to 8 of the agreement, 54 to 55 of the appendix, is subject to the equitable distribution.
Counsel,
then,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, and but I'd like to kind of, I want to go back in time just a little bit on the matter. And these cases, as you know, as a competent counsel, need to be set up properly. And it seems that the style of the case is Natalie Lowinger versus the estate of Stephen J. Lowinger. Is that the right styling of the case, or should it have been the personal representative?
Well, I saw that as an either-or situation. That you see cases, even cases cited by my opposition in this case, where the estate is being sued after the death of a party. And also you see other cases where the personal representative is the named party. Mm-hmm. I believe that this is an either-or situation and is a technical matter.
Do you have any authority for that?
Well, the fact that other cases exist in the equitable distribution world for the deceased spouse's interest being carried on in the style of the case by the name of the estate, yes, we have that right in.
But did those cases, I think the point that we're trying to make is, while there may be cases out there that are captioned that way,
yeah,
maybe, and I don't know, the issue of the status of the real party in interest wasn't established in that case, wasn't an issue, so therefore the court didn't deal with it.
Well, I don't think that there is an issue of the real party. The real party is the entity of the estate. And the personal representatives and the executors and co-executors in the state appointed by will, that's also because, as you know, Virginia treats testate estates separately from intestate estates for the purpose of litigation, because you end up with direct inheritance in an intestate situation. And then you only have the personal representative associated with certain aspects of the estate in those intestate cases. So, I believe that's something that was an objection that was waived at below when we filed our motion to name the estate as the successor party.
If you don't have a properly named party, how can you ever waive that? I mean, you're not properly before the court. If you've sued a non-entity, then how are you before the court?
Well, it's certainly not a non-entity. This is the estate is the registered entity for the purpose of the administration. The estate isn't going to change. A personal representative can.
Let's call it a non-responsible entity. Let's use another adjective to define it. A non-responsible entity. How can the estate satisfy the remedy that you seek in this case?
Because a judgment against the estate would be paid by the estate.
Why isn't this covered by 801-229-B2, death of a person against whom personal action may be brought? If a person against whom a personal action may be brought dies before commencement of such action, before the expiration of the limitation period, etc., may be filed against the decedent's estate, or an action may be commenced against the decedent's personal representative. Doesn't that answer the question for you?
Seemed like it did. I said it was an either or sort of thing. I was concerned about spending time on that for the short 15 minutes. And you're killing me. So I wanted to show that what we have to look at is the fact that there are enormous waivers by the wife in this. The wife has waived alimony, she's waived access to the personal, she's waived she's waived her interest in a very substantial retirement account system established by Mr. Loewinger, and has even waived the fact that he would be able to contribute to that, because he was already an older gentleman when they got married. She has waived the right to challenge any contributions he would make to that account. So it's not even a point in going back to 2004 and showing that, you know, he took $50,000 from the sale of the house in his retirement account, because all of that is waived. So what keeps the agreement fair? Okay. On the one hand, you got all these waivers. On the other hand, you're saying that the Bethesda house has its own remedy, that the wife will get half the equity if and only if the parties get a divorce.
But on appellate review, our job is not to determine what's fair, right? It's what the plain meaning of the words are of the contract. Right. If it's ambiguous, then to look behind that if necessary. Are you saying that the contract is ambiguous and so it requires parole?
I know. You see, to me, I just read the contract and this is what I came up with, and it seemed right. It didn't seem like I wasn't going to read this and find an ambiguity. You know, the courts don't have the rights, whether it's Virginia or Maryland. I have a Maryland case on that, of course, but, you know, they don't have the right to write a new contract for the parties. But on the other hand, they can't ignore the one that's already made to avoid an apparent hardship. And the apparent hardship in this case for the husband is, hey, you know, this equity has been dissipated before we get to 2012. You're imposing a huge hardship on me to have to come up with this now, 8 years after we sold it. So to answer your question, is it fair? Well, no. Let's apply the law. Let's apply the contract. And the contract says it's divided between the parties, not equitably distributed, which is a creature statute. And, you know, we walk around with equitable distribution principles and all of those factors in our heads as lawyers, as judges, and we're trapped in that convention. So when you have a contract which just uses the simple word divide at time of divorce, what do we do? We fall back into the equitable distribution box. And I'm saying, let's get out of that box, read the contract, and divide the equity 8 years later, just the way it's written in the agreement.
Was there any evidence of the refinancing introduced before the trial court to allow the trial court to make that calculation based upon the way that you thought it was more appropriate to make?
With regard to the calculation of the refinancing, my point there is, we have an agreement. If you want to modify the agreement based on some refinancing, modify the agreement.
Okay, but was there any evidence to provide to the trial court so the trial court could make the calculations consistent with the way that you thought the calculation should be made?
Well, yes. Basically, we had Exhibit A showing what the original debt was, which was agreed as of 1999. Then you have the HUD 1, which was submitted and is actually part of this record and part of this appendix, which shows what the amount of the actual debt was, which by now had increased somewhat. I don't walk around those numbers.
$311,898.55.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. I walk around with numbers in my head.
I stand admonished by the court in my head. But the point is, doesn't the agreement say if you're going to make a modification, even to Exhibit A, it's going to be in writing? So if he wanted to refinance that property and sell it out basically back to the bank for $740,000 and then sell it and say there's only $60,000 in equity, we would still object. We'd say, no, you can't do that, because it's the 500 that controls and subject to the debt that's in the agreement. And Judge McCahill went on to say, well, what about the payments on the debt and that resulted in an increase in equity, but not an increase in appreciation? Moot point. They refinanced. They didn't have an increase in equity based on paying down the principal on the note in this case.
Okay, counsel, you have about a minute left in rebuttal. Would you like to reserve that?
I will.
Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, Vernon Johnson from Nixon Peabody for the appellee in this case, the estate of Stephen J. Loewinger. This is a very clear case, and the result on appeal is very clear for all three of the reasons that we have briefed in our brief of appellee. I'd like to start, because I think it was the subject of most discussion earlier, on the issue of the proper party to pursue this relief. And I recognize the statute, Judge Huff, that you cited, 801-229-B2, which on its face you could read as suggesting that basically the appellant had a choice where they could pursue either the estate or the personal representative. But that is not the law in the Commonwealth and has never been the law in the Commonwealth. In fact, going all the way back to the Reynolds versus Williams case, a 1927 case, which is still good law, the rule is that if you are pursuing a personal claim like this, you have to pursue it against the personal representative. And there are an awful lot of cases. The Swan versus Marks case from 1996 stands for that proposition. But there's a whole series of cases that we did not cite, but they're easily located, where an issue came up because somebody had died while litigation was pending, and the plaintiff decided to pursue the estate and not the personal representative. And the fact of the matter is that the estate and the personal representative are recognized as totally different entities under Virginia law, and you cannot pursue a personal action against the estate. It's a nullity. You see this very often where it comes up in a situation where the statute of limitations has run and the plaintiff realizes that they have a problem, and they try to use the misnomer argument to get around it and say, well, I named the estate, but it's a misnomer. And the Supreme Court has made it very clear that naming the wrong party is not a misnomer. Misnaming the correct party is a misnomer. And in those situations, uniformly, it's been found that the party pursuing the estate was pursuing the wrong party and could not do that and had let the statute run against the correct party. We have a situation here where even if the appellant had a proper argument to make, the fact that they've styled the case as one against the estate is a nullity. An estate under Virginia law is really just a collection of property. If you had an in rem action, for example, against real estate, that would be a situation where you could name the estate. The case at bar is not such a situation. That is one of several fatal flaws in the appellant's argument. But
it's been suggested, and I believe that this is still the current state of the law, that divorce action is considered an in rem action, correct?
Well, the divorce itself is, and aspects of it could be, for example, if there was an effort to attach real estate or attach certain property. That's not what we have here. The property, really the funds that are the subject of this appeal, are gone. And they were gone long ago, and it was an undisputed factual finding, not challenged on this appeal, that those funds were used and applied at a time when the marriage was not in distress. And there was no argument of waste or dissipation.
So the proper application of an in rem action, I'm trying to follow your logic here, is that if the estate was holding a piece of property that had been subject to equitable distribution, say, you know, the vacation home, the estate was holding that, not the personal representative, but rather the estate could be sued to recoup that property that was the subject of the equitable distribution action, because that is a traditional in rem action.
I think that's right, Judge Alston. Okay. And it's not the situation, of course, that we have here.
Because they're pursuing money here.
Correct. Okay. And the money's gone. So they're basically asking for a money judgment against the estate, which they can't do. In addition to the fact that there are two other arguments that we've made, and I do want to address the equitable distribution argument, because of course the standard of review of an appeal from an equitable distribution award is very well settled, and it's abuse of discretion.
I appreciate your segueing into that, counsel. Judge McCahill, who is not only a colleague but a very, very able colleague when it comes to these kinds of cases. He's quite frankly an expert in these kinds of cases. seem to question, approach this case as an equitable distribution case. Was that correct?
Well, nobody objected to that. They had an equitable distribution hearing, and the court went through the factors and made an equitable distribution
award. Which kind of threw me, because it's not really an equitable distribution case. It's a contract interpretation case.
Well, certainly it could have been framed that way. And in the appendix, you have the complaint and you have the answer, which put the matter at issue. And from that, the hearings were held in order to determine the issues that were in dispute. I have to confess to you, and maybe it's clear, but just so it is clear, I was not trial counsel for Mr. Loewinger. And I have to confess that I don't know exactly how they got from the pleadings that put the case at issue to an equitable distribution hearing, but that's where they were. And
so I'm not standing in the dark alone as far as that.
No, sir. And in fact, though, I think it was clear to everybody that that was the exercise that they were going through. In fact, if you look at the objection that was noted in the order, it refers to the fact that in deciding the equitable distribution, the appellant was taking the position that Judge McCahill had erred. So I don't think anybody ever objected to the fact that there was an equitable distribution framework to decide this issue. And once you're there, it's an abuse of discretion standard, and it's fatal to this appeal that the appellant never discusses that standard, never argues it, never even says there was an abuse of discretion.
Let's assume, for the sake of discussion, that this case is not an equitable distribution case. What would be the standard of review for this court?
Well, I think it would have to be depend on what the exact claim was. For example,
let's look at it as a contract claim.
If the appellant had sued the appellee and he were still alive, mm-hmm, for breach of contract, then you'd have a contract interpretation case. Now, exactly how that would play out, I don't know, but assume that it played out similar to what we see in the transcript in this case. Then I think you'd have a decision to make. Is the contract clear and unambiguous? And nobody here argued that there was any ambiguity, but the trial court would still be permitted to make that decision as to whether there was an ambiguity, and if there was, to consider parole evidence in construing what the contract was intended to mean. I think here, if you look at the contract as it was written, the only way to get to the result that the appellant wants is to read additional language into the contract, which you can't do. She is basically asking the Court of Appeals to decide as a matter of law that when the parties negotiated and entered into this premarital agreement sometime years before the marriage was in distress, they agreed that if the marital property at issue was sold in 2004 or any other time, that somehow the husband would be under an obligation to preserve those funds inviolate just in case sometime years later there might be a divorce, in which case those funds would still be available for the wife to share in. The funds were gone. There's no dispute about that. So the request would be to enter a judgment against the husband for breach of that contractual obligation to preserve those funds. You have to read so much additional language into that agreement to get there that it goes beyond what the court would ever be allowed to do, even if this were an ambiguous contract situation, because it doesn't say anything at all about putting funds in trust or holding them in trust or holding them for the benefit of somebody. It clearly envisions a situation where if this property is still held at the time of divorce, then the appreciation will be treated as marital property. That's the only logical way to read it, and you don't have to put additional language into the agreement to read it that way. In order to adopt the appellant's interpretation, you have to basically rewrite the party's contract for them. Whether it's an equitable distribution framework or not, there's no mechanism for the trial court to do that. The other issue here that I do want to address, and I'm glad to answer any questions that the panel has, but we had also pointed out that the death of Mr. Loewinger really puts an end to this case, not just under the principles for a personal action that we've cited, but under the agreement itself, because the agreement does waive a lot of things, there's no question about it, But there was no dispute to the underlying validity of that agreement. Nobody claimed that it was coerced unfairly or anything like that. But it included a complete waiver of any claims against an estate.
But isn't that provision, the purpose of that provision, it's a standard provision, I expect, in these prenuptial agreements. It's so that the surviving spouse can't waive take the statutory share to circumvent the amount that is left to them under the prenup.
That is certainly one goal of that, so that to prevent a double dipping, if you will.
Right.
But it doesn't say that it's confined to that. It is an express and complete waiver of any claim against an estate. So when Mr. Loewinger died, I think that the result that was dictated by the agreement the parties had was that any right to pursue him or his estate ended then and there completely, and not just as a matter of law, but as a matter of the contract that the parties entered into and agreed to. And that result has to obtain.
Does it make any difference that it was a personal action, not an in rem action? And so it wouldn't be against the estate, it would be against the personal representative?
Well, but a personal action abates at the person's death, and not as a matter of law as well. But I don't think it makes a difference. I think that the way that this agreement was set up, the parties agreed that if one of us dies, then our will, last will and testament, will determine where the assets go, not this agreement. And we're waiving any claim otherwise. So we are agreeing that whatever the statutory share or whatever the will says, whatever it is, it's a probate matter, and that's how it'll be dealt with. Not as part of a divorce, not as equitable distribution, not by way of any other mechanism that the law has to decide those issues. I think they're all very clear. I also do know Judge McCahill very well, and I would agree that he's an expert in these matters. He clearly looked very closely at all the evidence, and there's not a single factual determination that he made that's challenged on this appeal directly or indirectly. And in that regard, there have been several questions related to the use of the funds that we're talking about and the fact that part of them were used to buy a car for the benefit of the appellant. There's also at least some inferential evidence, and it's discussed at pages 91 to 92 of the appendix, that when they bought a subsequent marital property, that there were withdrawals of funds from the very same account where these funds were kept right at about the same time, which at least invites the inference that part of the funds that we're talking about went to purchase a marital home, which clearly benefited both the husband and the wife. And you don't have a situation here, and it was never argued, for example, that the husband wasted or dissipated the assets, and there was never a showing that he did so at a time when the marriage was in distress. In fact, the undisputed factual finding of Judge McCahill, based on the evidence that he heard, was that the marriage was not in distress when these funds were spent. And moreover, the appellant didn't seek an alternate valuation date or make a claim for waste or dissipation. Just really, as far as I can tell, allowed this matter to proceed in the equitable distribution context, where you're in the realm of abusive discretion. And once you allow it to go down that path, your avenue for appeal is much more limited than if you had pursued it as a breach of contract action. And you have to argue and prove abusive discretion, which is a very tall order based on the cases from this court and the Supreme Court that talk about appeal from an equitable distribution award. Again, this is a very clear case on all the issues that we have raised, and we would ask that the appeal be denied and that Judge McCahill's rulings be affirmed completely. I'm glad to answer any further questions that the panel might have.
I think we're fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have about a minute.
I'll take 30 seconds.
Yes, sir.
If the estate is not a proper party at this stage, okay, the dismissal would be without prejudice. We'd be back in here for the purpose of renaming a party. I don't think that it would be fatal, as my opponent addresses. As to the equitable distribution hearing, there was an equitable distribution hearing. The case proceeded on equitable distribution because there were two pieces of property, greatly at great dispute as to whether or not they were joint property under the agreement for the purpose of equitable distribution. In my objection, in my exceptions to the judge's ruling, I made it clear we are objecting to the interpretation of the premarital agreement with respect to how Judge Cahill applied the equity in the Bethesda House. We were not addressing Judge Cahill's findings of facts, and we don't feel that this is a case that addresses facts. This simply addresses whether or not there was a latent payment that was established as to amount upon the sale of the house in 2004 that then became due in 2012. And in order to achieve harmony in the marriage, we didn't look at what happened to that money in the interim 8 years. And then—
I counsel, your time has expired. I'll give you 10 seconds to sum up.
Thank you very much. It is not logical to look at this as an equitable distribution case. There was no waste and dissipation issue. There was no alternate valuation date issue because it was not, as regard to Bethesda House, an equitable distribution issue.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come down to Greek counsel.